Have you ever noticed the life of a honeybee? Spending endless hours in the flowers gathering.
Good afternoon and welcome to Salida Yard and Garden here on KHEN Radio. I am your host, Kurt Jones, and I work as the County Extension Director here in Chaffee County. And through the magic that that is the internet, I am able to be joined today by one of my colleagues, Lisa Mason from Arapahoe, Colorado University Extension in Arapahoe County. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Welcome, Lisa. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. And speaking of being here, we're going to talk about bees today, aren't we? I had to get that little pun in.
Absolutely.
Many of my listeners know that I'm a beekeeper, but your interest is actually a bit more in the native bees as opposed to the scoundrels that I keep in hives, of course.
That is correct, but no bees are scoundrels. All okay. Bees are good.
good. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff that you've got going on.
Yeah, well, I started a citizen science program as part of my graduate school research back in 2016 called the Native Bee Watch Citizen Science Program. And this program looks at native bee populations and abundance. Native bees, so in Colorado specifically, we have over 900 species of bees, which is quite a lot of diversity. Mm-hmm. And of course, we can't identify all 900 species in the field because you need a microscope and a lot of taxonomic expertise to be able to identify them. So what we've done is we've taken common characteristics that are easily visible in the field while they're visiting flowers. And so our citizen scientists are looking, watching for bees visiting flowers, recording the plant that they're visiting, and then recording what category of bee they fall into. This collective database will hopefully help us learn more about what plants bees are visiting here in Colorado, and also give us an idea, you know, long-term of maybe some trends as well, because we don't have a lot of data specifically on native bee populations and abundance.
Oh, cool. So you said 900 species here in Colorado.
Correct.
I think I read somewhere it's something like 2,000 native bee species in the United States.
I know in all of North America, it's about 4,000.
Oh, okay. So it's just a number I made up, but I guessed low, I guess.
It could be the United States specifically is closer to 2,000, but I know, okay. So I'd have to check on that. But North America, it's about 4,000 bees.
Wow. So you said this was part of your graduate work. How did that work out for you? How many volunteers did you have, how'd that work for you?
Well, the first part of the project, which was my master's research, was determining, are these bee protocols effective? Because we want to make sure we're collecting accurate data that can be used for research. And so my advisor, co-advisors, Arathi Seshadri and Boris Kondratyov at CSU, we determined the protocols for collecting this data. And what we did is citizen scientists collected data, and then researchers collected data as well. And so we wanted to compare the quality of data from the researchers compared to the citizen scientists. And what we found is that citizen scientists did a pretty good job. There are some areas of improvement, and we continually need to engage with citizen scientists to ensure data accuracy. But overall, we found that citizen scientists can collect pretty comparable data to researchers with a lot of education and engagement, and this can be a valuable tool for the long term. So that paper was published in a peer-reviewed journal. And so now our next step is to expand the program a little bit. And this program initially started in Fort Collins, Colorado. I am down in Arapahoe County, which is Centennial, Colorado. So we expanded to Centennial last summer. This summer, due to the pandemic, we've had to switch protocols since we don't want to get large groups of people together. So we have actually converted the program to go virtual. And so all training will be done virtually. And the data collected, instead of public gardens, we will be looking for data in your own backyard. So anyone in Colorado can participate. We have information on the Arapaho County Extension website. Our first training is this Thursday at 5:30. We also have a training next Wednesday at 2 p.m. The trainings are about 3 hours long, and we have a short little quiz after to see how your knowledge is, and that's just to help us ensure the data collected is accurate. I promise, though, in 3 hours, it'll be engaging. It's going to be a good time. So we're excited to collect all this data electronically. You can download the app on your phone to collect the data, and we're real excited this summer.
Well, very cool. And of course, it's virtual, which means that we don't have to drive to Littleton to come take the class. And when I learned about this last week, I was like, oh, I've got to get Lisa on my radio program, because I'll bet there's some folks around here that that would love to participate in that. So you said the details of that training are on the Arapaho County Extension website. Do you have that? Is that easy to remember? Is it a really long URL?
It is a long URL, but I can spell it out really easily. So it's arapaho.extension.colostate.edu/, and it's Native BWatch Citizen Science Program with a hyphen between each of those words. Okay. Native-B-Watch Citizen Science Program.
Okay.
You can also navigate to it from the homepage of the Arapaho County Extension website.
Okay. Yeah, that's very cool. And of course, Arapaho County Extension's famous for their chick cam when they do their baby chicks in the incubator and stuff. So, Lisa, now Lisa, you work as the horticulture agent there in Arapaho County. Is that what I recall?
Correct.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's say that this program explodes. You have 100 people in your class this summer from all four corners of the state. What are you hoping to learn about with this?
Well, that would be a wonderful problem to have, and we might need a little patience as we work through, you know, we're doing all this virtual programming very quickly to adapt during this pandemic time. So we're trying to work through the hiccups now, so when we actually do the training, there won't be any. But if we get, you know, widespread data from all over Colorado, we're collecting the data through a program called ArcGIS, which is spatial information. Mm-hmm. So we can actually plot where all the data is coming in at on a map. And so that'll give us an idea of the regions and the areas. And from there, we can look at what plants they're visiting and how that varies from area to area. And initially, you know, this might further inform homeowners or city planners or open space planners what type of plants that the native bees are visiting, or honeybees too. We are definitely counting honeybees as well, because beekeeping is a very important hobby, especially in urban areas for homeowners. So we're counting all bees. So we can look at what flowers they're visiting, and that can really inform people on a local level what they can plant. Bigger picture and long term, you know, we can definitely look at the patterns and to look at patterns of the populations. We definitely will need more than 1 year's worth of data, but we can start to look at patterns and see what we see. Mm-hmm. The other exciting part of the research that we're doing is we received a small grant to look at how adults are learning the citizen science. So I have a partnership with Professor Jill Zaretsky, and she's with the School of Education at Colorado State University, and she specializes in adult learning. And so we want to know what are the gaps, first of all, in the training. How can we improve this training and improve this program to better accommodate our citizen scientists, which in turn will hopefully lead to higher data quality and better data. And then we also want to look at how adults are learning the science and if adults are changing their behaviors. So if a volunteer learns about pollinator habitat and watches all these flowers being visited by bees, are they more likely to maybe plant those plants in their backyard or take more of a role in their community to advocate for pollinators? So we're pretty stoked about that as well.
Yeah, very cool. And I was just, while you were visiting here, I was exploring some things on the internet here real quick. First of all, we just did a two-part Habitat for Pollinators program here on KHN Radio. We planned on doing it 2 weeks in a row. However, with the pandemic, we did the first half of the program on March 10th, and then everything shut down for... between that one and the second week, and I was finally able to get the second half of that Habitat for Pollinators program put together. And frankly, we used a lot of the information that is in your fact sheet that you wrote here a couple of years ago. Colorado State University Extension has a number of short fact, what we call fact sheets. Not fat sheets, but fact, F-A-C-T sheets. And so there's a number of different suggestions for different plants that work there. Of course, I've taught the Carl Beekeeper Mentorship Program for several years now, and we always spend an entire week on pollinator habitat and learning what's blooming in your area and stuff. So if you're interested in getting into pollinator habitats, of course, you don't have to join the citizen science group to do so, but if you just want to plant some extra plants in your backyard, we have a number of different references that would work well for you. But since you're going to be spending so much time in your backyard admiring all the new habitat that you've created, why not think about joining this program? It's this coming Thursday evening. Of course, you have to pre-register, as I recall. So, so we need to get you in touch with that. Again, if you missed Lisa's contact information, you're more than welcome to reach out to me. Probably the easiest for me is if you sent me an email at kurt.jones@colostate.edu. That would be the easiest. Otherwise, right now our office is still closed, but you're always welcome to contact me on my cell phone at 395-5493. So, Lisa, any plans for another training coming up here, or is this the one and done before the summer season? Do you know yet?
So
Yeah, I was going to say not to add a bunch of work to your plate, but.
No, not at all. So we have the two plans. So one's this Thursday, and then one is next Wednesday from 2 to 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll probably reassess if this program has a huge demand and we are not able to accommodate that demand with the two trainings. We will probably consider offering a training in early June. But, you know, since we're doing this virtually this year, we're not sure how many people to expect or anything. So we'll definitely be a little bit flexible there.
Sure. And do you have to be in both trainings to?
Good question. You do not. You only need to attend one or the other.
I see. Fantastic. I misunderstood that. I thought it was you had to do Thursday night and Wednesday afternoon, but it sounds like you can do either or.
Correct. Yes.
Probably not both, because you might be taking the time slot from somebody else. But
yeah. Potentially, it depends on how many people are interested. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. So the other thing I was looking at here on our state website is if you were looking through publications and the insects and just some of the general interest subjects. There's what I would call a white paper that's called Native Bee Watch here that I'm sure that you had quite a bit to do with here. 32-page fact sheet. Nah, that's not quite What a fact sheet.
A field guide.
Yes. So this was something that you created during your master's program, I'm assuming.
Yes. Yeah. And the fields guide is a great resource to, even if you're not interested in collecting data, it's a great resource just to have on hand so you can learn more about the type of bees you might be observing, you know, just see on a whim on a flower. Gives you an idea of the variety of sizes and shapes and colors and bees that we have in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And then it also talks a little bit about what is pollination, why it's important, and the different lifestyles of bees. You know, we have social bees, like the honeybee. We also have, most of our bees are solitary, meaning they don't live in a man-made hive. They live underground or in a cavity and live a very different lifestyle than some of our other bees. So a good reference to just have on hand.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know that I've been asked about how to build native bee boxes out in the backyard. Looks like you've got some pictures of cavity nesters and that type of thing. So do those bee boxes work?
They do, but they have to be done and built correctly. So there's a lot of great tutorials out there. I would recommend using a tutorial from a university. Michigan State University actually has a really great fact sheet on building native bee hotels. And kind of the basics are you want to use a material that's breathable. So soft wood, like pine or something that you can drill holes into, will work well. There's a lot of companies out there that sell cardboard tubes for mason bees and leaf cutter bees. Those work really well. You want to make sure that your tubes are at least 6 inches long. That's real important. And you also want to make sure there's a back to the bee hotel too. So you don't want just tubes. You want tubes that are open on one end with a backing on the other end.
Okay.
And that'll help ensure that the bees will be successful. But a lot of great information out there. Just make sure to do a little research.
Okay. So I know that a lot of people get very nervous about having bees in their backyard. I'm thinking of my 11-year-old daughter who absolutely scared me to death the other day because she was screaming at an alfalfa moth that seems to be prevalent right now, very similar to a Miller moth. But she's spooked about any bees in the backyard, and the bulk of our bees that I've seen recently, I do know there's some honeybees in my neighborhood, but I've seen an awful lot of bumblebees flying around.
Which is
good to see.
That is good to see, and I think it's important to note. You know, most people assume insect stings come from bees, when in fact, quite often they're coming from wasps. And specifically, yellow jackets are actually responsible for over 90% of the stings here in Colorado. So for anyone that's worried about bees specifically, you know, bees don't want to sting you. And in fact, honeybees don't survive after they sting you. So they really will only sting if they are feeling very threatened. So I think that's important to note. And a lot of our native bees actually don't sting. So you don't have to worry about them either. Bumblebees can sting, but again, they're really, they just want to mind their own business. So you would really have to threaten a bumblebee in order to get stung by a bumblebee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They just, when they're flying by and you hear them buzzing as they're flying, it can get your heart going a little bit. So
it is a little intimidating. Yes. Yep. Yeah. But it's important to know that they are out for, they're vegetarians. They are out to collect pollen and nectar and protect their young and their hives. So they really don't want to interact with humans too much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I was just looking at the keys to identifying bees in your booklet here. This is one of the easiest dichotomous keys I've ever seen. This is fantastic. It asks questions like, it appears fuzzy hair on the thorax or appears fuzzy over the entire body, does not appear fuzzy. So you're even using technical terms that even I can understand. So.
Yes. Yeah. And it is important to note that the bees in there, there's 8 different categories of bees, and they all share a similar characteristic. So they aren't, you know, there could be a variety of species and genera or genera mm-hmm. in each category. So I'll give you an example. We have a category called hairy belly bees. And hairy belly bees have a very specific characteristic of special pollen collecting hairs on the underside of their abdomen. So leaf cutter bees and mason bees are great examples of that. So when you see a leaf cutter bee, you know, quite often she'll actually stick up her abdomen a little bit, and you can see the underside of her abdomen is just covered in pollen. That's very characteristic for that group.
I see. Very cool. Of course, honeybees have their corbicula the pollen baskets on their hind legs. So you know, it's very characteristic of them when they're out collecting, or frankly, when they're returning with a bunch of pollen that they've collected. It's going to be all over their back legs. So, although there is, I see a hairy leg bee as well. So.
Now, that's going to differ from the honeybee a little bit and bumblebees. So, like you said, honeybees and bumblebees carry pollen in corbiculae or pollen baskets. So, you're going to see a round ball of pollen and nectar on their hind legs, where the hairy leg bees actually have very bristly, long hairs on their hind legs, and the pollen really sticks to it. So you can almost picture it like these bees are wearing bright yellow leg warmers, almost, the bright yellow legs. So they do carry it differently than bees with pollen baskets.
Yeah. Is there much of a size difference between honeybees and, say, the hairy leg bees?
That's an excellent question. A lot of the hairy leg bees are actually larger than honeybees and comparable to bumblebee sized.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, yep. And I've recently had questions from folks about They were concerned about honeybees. I think what they were concerned about was actually yellow jackets. Very, very different critters. A lot of us beekeepers really question what is the purpose of a Western yellow jacket. But you don't have to answer that question.
Okay, I'm happy to, but that might take us down a different tangent. But you know, yellow jackets. I will say this. You know, yellow jackets are scavengers, where other wasps are hunters. You know, so wasps in general provide pest control for us. They feed on a lot of caterpillars and provide a very important role in the ecosystem. But yellow jackets are scavengers, and that can make them a little aggressive, you know, when they're searching for food. They're the ones that are picnics and barbecues and they're the ones that are most likely to sting us.
Yeah. I know the bulk of my quote unquote bee stings come from yellow jackets in the month of August into September, when I'm actually trying to take the honey crop from my beehives. And I frankly get stung as many times by the yellow jackets as I do the honeybees. And I think it's because the honeybees are just so ticked off at the yellow jackets trying to steal all their honey, that anybody opening up the hive is going to get stung. So.
I believe it. Yep.
And,
I believe it.
Yeah. So, well, very, very cool. Neat program. Remind our listeners, is there a cost for this program?
It is free and open to the public.
Okay. So, so the first one is happening this Thursday evening. The second one is next Wednesday afternoon. You said this evening or this Thursday evening is 6:30? 5:30 to 8:30, and then next Tuesday or next Wednesday is 2:30 to 5:30.
2 to 5.
I can make up numbers as you wish. So, well, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us here today. It's a little bit of a shorter program here today, but that's okay. It's been a long week, and most of us are wanting to be outside. It's gorgeous weather outside here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And if anyone is interested or has questions about native bees, feel free to reach out to me or through Kurtz, and I'm happy to answer and help out.
Yeah, sounds great. And again, you can reach out to me at kurt.jones@colostate.edu as my email, or you're welcome to give me a call on my cell phone at 719-395-5493. You've been listening to Salida Yard and Garden here on KHAN Radio, and thank you so much for listening.